I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. As we mark the 100th anniversary of the birth of Jane Jacobs and 10 years after her death, a new book collects essays, articles, speeches, and interviews of the influential writer and thinker. These works illuminate her thinking over her professional life and the evolution of her thinking from before the publication of the seminal The Death and Life of Great American Cities and the Economy of Cities, as well as after those books inspired a change in how cities were regarded, even inspiring generations of urban planners and activists. The book is edited by the writer and historian Samuel Zip and Nathan Storing, who joins me now. I'll get Mr. Storing to tell us about the life of Jacobs, her ideas, and her legacy. Nathan Storing is a curator, writer, and designer who specializes in making contemporary architecture and city planning accessible to the general public. He has served as curator of Urban Space Gallery in Toronto and currently works at Project for Public Spaces, an urban advocacy organization. He has degrees from the Ontario College of Art and Design and Brown University. His website is at nathanstoring.com. The book is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in Toronto today, Nathan Storing. Mr. Storing, good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So in this centenary of Jacobs' birth, yours is a book among a few. I just noticed there was about at least three or four?
Yeah, there are definitely a couple others out there. There's a biography that's about her whole life. There's an intellectual biography, which is just the part before she wrote Death and Life of Great American Cities, and it really traces all of the ideas that came up in that book. And then I think there's a collection of interviews as well, including the last interview that she had.
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, for historians and for urban planners and people that study her work, this is probably a good time to revisit it, especially since it's 10 years after her death, right?
Right, absolutely. I think it's a great time to go back and take a look. I hope that, you know, this book kind of adds something to the mix. There is a lot about Jane Jacobs out there right now, but this is the only book that is really by Jane Jacobs.
Yeah. So one of the things that I was thinking about as I was reading this book was how, I guess we sort of regard Jacobs as she's used by the left a lot and has been for a number of years in terms of say, bolstering ideals on that side of the political aisle, if you will. But the right as well has taken on Jacobs in a way. So one of the things you talk about in the book is how she's regarded by both the left and the right. And has that changed over the years, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think early on, particularly, she was more allied with the left, or at least she had more of a following on the left. And it's only over the years, particularly as she wrote more and more about economics, I think, that the right started to feel more of a kinship with her, particularly if you have libertarian leanings or you're a fan of Friedrich Hayek and those sorts of economists, then you might find a lot to like in Jane Jacobs.
Yeah, so a lot of the people have overlooked, and you can tell me what part of her life this was. I guess this was in the later part of her life, that she would call for the privatization of utilities, of transportation, and mail delivery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was primarily, I think, it started in the 80s. Mm-hmm. But she'd been thinking about this for a long time, and she did call for the privatization of those things. But you know, there's so much nuance, I guess, mm-hmm. In her thinking on this stuff. It's hard to say that she was really of the left or of the right at all. But she appealed to all of them, and if you read her closely, I think there's a lot to challenge both sides.
Yeah, and if you read her closely, it's hard to pin her down politically, but also she took on things like academia. She had a very dim view of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to really explain her. I mean, well, I don't know. Is it because you and Mr. Zip here have edited her work? I have edited this collection, I should say, of her work. I mean, did you find that there are contradictions in her?
I mean, the one thing that's fascinating is that despite all of the nuance and all of the sort of how hard it is to pin her down, I think a lot of it actually hangs together remarkably well and almost creates its own world of reasoning, I guess, you know, that incorporates all sorts of issues. whether you're talking about the design of cities or economics or regulation or feminism, environmentalism, it all, she has something to say about all of it, and it all actually seems to more or less fit together, at least in my mind.
So besides being important to people in your business, how has the work of Jacobs changed, say, life for all of us that live in cities? I mean, if you had to explain her influence on us today, what would would you tell people?
Sure. So, I mean, I think first and foremost, she had a huge impact on city planners and architects, which in turn has a big impact on people who live in cities in general. In particular, when she wrote The Death and Life of Great American Cities, the sort of thinking of the day was that cities were outmoded. The cities that had been built in the first half of the century and before that were, dirty, dangerous, overcrowded, all of that. And what she said is that, no, in fact, there's this marvelous order underneath what looks like chaos that actually helps all of us live together in cities. There are dynamics like what she called the eyes on the street, which is basically the idea that if you have a whole bunch of people that are occupying public space, then they will actually help keep it safe in a sort of casual, unintentional sort of way just by being there. That kind of order exists below the city, and you actually need the way that the city is built needs to be dense and mixed use and walkable and a mix of old and new, which is exactly what planners are trying to root out of cities at the time. So if you live in a place that's like that now, that's dense and mixed use and so on, that might be partly because of Jane Jacobs' influence. I also think that that sort of understanding of cities and what we love about cities, if you're a city lover, an urbanist out there, a lot of it is from Jane Jacobs. She's kind of become part of the common sense of our culture.
Yeah, and her sense of the city was from the ground up, if you will, mm-hmm. And I guess before her time, before her, I guess her influence, it was people like Robert Moses who looked at the city from above, and planned it that way.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. She was a big proponent of not just community involvement in planning, but really community-driven planning, which I still don't think that we've quite grasped that today, even though planners do like to gripe about NIMBYs, not in my backyard, mm-hmm. folks, who are opposing plans and so forth. I don't think that we really have a system that actually engages community in the creative process of making our cities. We put them in a very adversarial position.
How did you view gentrification? Because we're seeing a lot of that. I mean, you're in Vancouver, for example. Mm-hmm. The city's changing a great deal and rather quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. Jane Jacobs has been writing about gentrification since her first book, 1961. She acknowledges very plainly that, in fact, people who have more affluence and also, she says, more respectability are very capable of displacing people who have less, and that's a serious problem in cities. And she actually had a lot to say about even what we could do about gentrification. Lots of very specific strategies that she talked about, despite the fact that she was an opponent of the projects, as they were called, right, those sort of towers in the park and so forth.
Yeah.
She was a huge advocate of public housing, actually. She saw that as a very important part of the way that cities needed to be designed. And in Toronto, while she was here, she was involved with encouraging a program of infill public housing development. So not only was it adding to the housing stock, but it was also making sure that people who couldn't afford market-rate housing were mixed in with everyone else, and they weren't set apart in these sort of experiments, urban experiments. She had a lot to say about gentrification and doesn't always get the credit I think she deserves for that.
Yeah, this book of hers, the Death and Life of Great American Cities, you mentioned a moment ago, published in 1961. And how old was she when that came out?
I believe she was 45 when it was released.
Yeah. And so she, up to that point, she had made her living, I guess, not as an academic, not as an urban planner or anything like that, but as a journalist and a writer. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. Yeah. She had basically an entire life before she wrote Death and Life, an entire, quite a prominent career. first writing freelance during the Depression in New York. She wrote for Vogue magazine and a magazine called Q and a couple others, and for newspapers. And then she was actually a propagandist during the war, working for the U.S. government first to try and, you know, express American values abroad. And then she worked on a magazine called America, which was distributed in the USSR, and again, trying to kind of promote America as and American values and undercut the USSR during the Cold War.
And she met, I don't know, did she meet Hiss, or did she work with Hiss at the time?
She, I believe she worked with him loosely.
Yeah.
He gave, I believe Alger Hiss gave her a recommendation at some point when she was being promoted. And as it turns out, the FBI didn't like that because they were on Alger Hiss's trail as a potential communist threat.
Yeah.
And Jane Jacobs was actually investigated as well as a potential communist.
By Hoover himself, I read somewhere else.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. He oversaw the investigation. And she wrote this really eloquent rebuttal about why she's not a communist. And that's actually included in the book as well.
Yeah. So upon the publication of The Death and Life of American Cities, her renown, her influence increases. How did she regard that sort of fame aspect of it?
Yeah, so, I mean, from what I gather from Jim Jacobs, her son, she generally thought of anything that wasn't writing as a distraction from writing. So, whether it was, having to go give talks and those sorts of things, or even the activism that she became very famous for, she often saw as a sort of distraction from what she really wanted to be doing and needed to be doing, which was writing. That said, a lot of the content for this book ended up being exactly those distractions that she was annoyed by.
And so the pieces in the book go back to, say, the 30s, right?
Yeah,
some of
correct.
Her initial journalism, her initial writing. Do you notice, as you're going through her work, how her mind changes on various issues?
Yeah, absolutely. So the book is divided into five parts, and it was really difficult to figure out exactly where those cutoffs should be. But essentially, each part is adds a different layer of thinking to what she's talking about. So the very first part is that it's, her freelance work when she first arrives in New York, and she's really building up her writing chops, I think, at that point, and also observing the city very carefully. Which is something that she continued to do throughout the rest of her life and formed a basis for her broader thinking on all sorts of things. But she hadn't quite figured out how the city was ticking, what was really going on below the surface, and the processes that were driving what she was seeing. And then the second part, she starts to understand the design of cities and how that affects people's social interactions and the way city economies work and all of that. The third part, she really dives into economics and environmentalism and technology and some broader issues around that. The next part, she adds in ethics to the mix, and that really rounds out the whole thing. She called the built form, the economics and the ethics of cities, the ecology of cities. It was something that you could kind of study all together, just like an ecology in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last part kind of reviews all of that together, and she adds nuance to many of her old ideas, and then really looks to the future of cities and what our current time might have in store for us.
And she was writing right up to the end?
That's right. When she passed away, she was actually working on two unpublished books, and excerpts from both are in this collection.
The other thing that's in this collection that hasn't been published heretofore is her speech at the first Earth Day.
Yes, that's
and,
correct.
And just how influential was what she said that day in terms of how she viewed future challenges and how much influence has that had, say, on the rest of us after
right.
that?
So I mean, it's fascinating. She spoke alongside the founder of Earth Day, actually, Gaylord Nelson, and what she was saying at the time would have probably come across as pretty crazy. It was very against the grain of what environmentalists were thinking at the time. Particularly, she was a big advocate against population control. I don't think she really had much of an influence at all on the environmental movement in terms of that sort of issue. But, you know, as we see when, you know, we look at China and the one-child policy, I think what she was saying was actually very prescient. It created all sorts of problems that I think she kind of foresees a little bit in that speech.
Yeah, and the other thing that I found interesting was she's highly regarded in the United States, obviously, but in Canada there's a special connection because she moves here in the 1960s. And I guess she was a big deal in Toronto, wasn't she?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, she moved here in 1968 with her family, and they were leaving the U.S. because of the Vietnam War. Her sons were draft age, and both basically said, well, we'd rather be arrested than go to war, and she didn't want them to get arrested. So they end up moving to Toronto, and they move into an apartment building, or an apartment, I guess, in on Spadina Avenue, and this is right when the Spadina Expressway was being proposed. And so she had just left New York, where she was fighting an expressway battle that seemed never-ending, and right when she moves to this new city, suddenly there's another expressway knocking at her door. And so she was heavily involved with the fight against the Spadina Expressway and really got involved in Toronto politics and embedded in the community, I think, through that experience.
And she was highly regarded by politicians themselves, advising mayors of the city throughout the last part of her life, right?
Right. Yeah. And it's an interesting turn of events, because in New York she was very much an outsider in terms of the political landscape and an activist at the community level. And suddenly, when she comes to Toronto, once the Reform City Council comes in the 1970s. She finds a lot of allies at City Hall and really helps influence urban policy in Toronto for, you know, decades.
And she liked Toronto?
Oh, liked Toronto a lot, yeah. Absolutely.
And how did she view that in terms of an ideal city? I mean, I'm assuming because she lived there that she liked that and that's the way it should be. I mean, is there a line there that you could draw, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, I think she would always be careful to say that, you know, we shouldn't accept any kind of utopia, and no city is the right city. Every city, you know, should be its very best self. But you know, I think she did love Toronto for a couple key reasons. She called it once the city that works, which I think is telling about, you know, where her values lie, I guess, in sort of this functional view of the city that, you know, it is able to solve its own problems. Which is something that American cities at the time, she didn't feel like they could. Part of it was that Toronto, early on, recognized that urban renewal was not really solving the problems that it was supposed to solve. So you have some early projects like Regent Park, mm-hmm. but relatively speaking, Toronto didn't tear down very much of its city compared to many other places, including New York. So the fact that it still had all these functioning communities, I think, was a big part of why she saw it as an optimistic place.
What do you think she'd make of how our big cities have turned out? And you know, I'm speaking to you from Vancouver, where, you know, we're talking a lot about housing prices. I'm sure you're aware. And mm-hmm. you know, her house in Toronto that she lived in would be worth millions now, I bet.
Sure. Yeah, and I mean, I think it's something that she talked about a lot, especially later in her life. In one speech in the 2000s that's in the book, she talks about gentrification specifically and those sorts of challenges. But also in Dark Age Ahead, she has a whole chapter around affordability in general, which she saw, I think, it seems like she saw as a separate issue from gentrification in the sense that it affects the entire city, not just one neighborhood. And so, you know, she did have very specific views about how cities could address their affordability issues, which jive with what a lot of other economists are saying these days, which is essentially we're not building enough. which sounds so counterintuitive when you look at a city like Vancouver or Toronto, for that matter, where there's lots of construction happening. But I think one of the things she was very attuned to is the fact that urban renewal back in the day was actually replacing housing that was affordable with housing that was less affordable. Yeah. So the way we build is also very important. You see that in New York, for instance, where I've lost the neighborhood now from my mind, but one neighborhood where they tore down some older buildings and replaced them with high rises, they had inclusionary zoning, which means that there is supposedly affordable housing in the building, the new building. However, as it turns out, the affordable the housing is actually less affordable now than the buildings that were there before. So there was actually a net decrease in the amount of affordable housing in the neighborhood, even though there are policies to encourage it.
And so what would you think it would her advice be in terms of how we look to the future? I mean, is it without hope?
Well, it's interesting. Her final book, Dark Age Ahead.
Yeah.
You could read it as a sort of pessimistic book, and she says in the book that it's not, but the title sort of says otherwise.
Yeah, exactly.
That, there's this potential for cultural collapse, is what she says, that we're sort of undermining the things that have made our culture sustainable, whether you're talking about the way government works or community works. And so she definitely saw that, but the book that she was working on when she passed away was going to be called a short biography of the human race, which is a fairly ambitious topic. But
yeah.
she saw on the horizon an alternative to the Dark Age, which is that we're potentially entering what she called the era of human capital, which is sort of a fancy way of saying we're not going to be as focused anymore on acquiring land and natural resources, which is what drove civilizations for the past millennia, but instead we're actually going to be focused more on human capabilities and the fact that cities can kind of bring out those human capabilities, which sounds very vague, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll leave it to the reader to take a look at her speech and see what she was getting at, because it's really quite an interesting theory.
Yeah, she's terribly influential in your business, and inspired generations of people thinking about these issues. Her detractors today, I mean, I'm sure there are detractors of Jacobs's thinking. Are
right.
there?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think more than anything, I think people are just really hungry for a new way of thinking about cities. It's been more than half a century since Death and Life of Great American Cities was written, and I think it's still really one of the most influential visions for what a city ought to be like. And yet, we have all sorts of new challenges ahead of us, including things like climate change and income inequality and massive affordability challenges. That I think some people feel like we need new solutions to solve those problems. So I think that's where a lot of the criticism comes from. However, I think, again, if you read this collection, you'll find that she has a lot to say about all of those issues that we haven't really mined enough for solutions to our contemporary problems.
How did you and Samuel Zip come to edit this book?
Well, it's a long story, but essentially, as it turns out, my first job after my undergrad was working for some colleagues of Jane Jacobs on a different project that actually never quite got off the ground. But in the process, I read all of her work. I met a lot of people who knew her, and that's where I started to find these shorter writings. And the thing that really got me about these writings is they were really hard to get your hands on. A lot of them are only available if you, for instance, are in university.
Mm-hmm.
And you have access to the library, and even then, only certain libraries have them, architecture libraries usually. So that was sort of the beginnings of it, and then I met Sandy in Providence, Rhode Island, when I was going to Brown University. He was one of my professors. and I wrote a whole bunch of Jacob's essays in one of his classes, and mentioned that I was starting to come across all of this, these short writings. And we realized that it was Jacob's centenary this year, and he sort of said, well, you know, that sounds like a book.
Yeah.
So that's how we started collaborating on it.
And you're from Toronto, is that right?
I'm from Kitchener, Ontario, originally.
Yeah.
But I went to the Ontario College of Art and Design in Toronto and worked here for a couple years.
Yeah, and then you went to Brown, and that's where you met Professor Zip. The title of the book, Vital Little Plans, that was her philosophy, wasn't it? That we needed to pursue our own little plans in our own little neighborhoods, and that the big picture would sort of sort itself out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of one of the things that we take away from her work. And the thing that we like about this idea of little plans is that it kind of cuts across a lot of her thinking, whether you're talking about the design of cities and the planning of cities, or you're talking about economies or ethics and culture. You need to make room for the sort of non-conforming plans of individuals and communities. And what I will say, though, is that I don't think it's just about letting things go. It's not laissez-faire. It's really about creating a planning environment and having planners that are really attuned to what's going on, and not just standing back and letting things happen, but actively trying to encourage them. You know, again, to go back to this idea of whether she's on the left or the right, I mean, I think a lot of people on the right would be surprised to hear that she did advocate for government to get directly involved in the regulation of markets, and particularly regulating large companies in such a way that it gave a bigger advantage to young and new companies, small companies, in the market to kind of create that churn. So she didn't want planners and economists and regulators to just stand back. She wanted them to make room for vital little plans.
The other thing I enjoyed about the book a great deal, Nathan, was the obviously her writing, but you guys put a lot of work in terms of the footnotes and the sort, and I enjoyed reading those and getting a sense of, she mentions an actor, say, of
right.
the era, and, you know, I wouldn't know who that was, and you give us the context. And I mean, that must have been fun, too, for both of you, was it?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to kind of track down all of those things, and we just wanted to make it as accessible as possible,
yeah.
And when you're including, a century-old piece of writing, you know, not quite, but from the 1930s, you know, there's inevitably going to be things that just don't quite translate anymore. So we wanted to make sure that everyone could still access those things, and also kind of connect her ideas, too. If she mentioned something that's in one of her other books, we wanted to kind of draw that connection and say, well, that makes, you know, you should also look at this over here and think about what the connection might be.
Well, you both have done a great service with this book. Congratulations and good luck with it, and thanks for your time today.
Thanks very much. Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. NathanStoering.com is the website. Vital Little Plans, the Short Works of Jane Jacobs, is published by Random House. It's edited by Samuel Zip and Nathan Storing. Mr. Storing, join me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.